The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsigned Methods with me, Lachlan Bloom.
And me, Jamie Batchin.
If this is the first time you're listening to the podcast, this is part of a series where we talk to fellow authors about their process and technique.
So this month we are speaking to Iman Mersel, who is an Egyptian writer, a poet originally, who's also worked in nonfiction, quite creative nonfiction, we spoke to her about, who's currently based in Canada and has been for quite a while.
Yeah, we had a great chat talking about the sort of line between fiction and nonfiction and how she sees her process and practice and how it's evolved alongside the politics that sort of is entwined with her writings.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she had some really interesting stuff to talk about, her journey towards sort of poetry and stuff as well. And I think there's some really interesting cultural stuff that she goes through. And also the idea that writing the Arabic language, which is the language she primarily writes her poetry in, there is a quite a set poetic form of that that's been in existence for over a millennium, I think she said. So you can read some very old texts that are readily accessible to, you know, primary school children, secondary school children, but it also means that there are some pretty strong structures in place and people expect poetry to look a certain way. So it was great to hear her viewpoint on that.
Yeah, it was fascinating as well that she's lived in Canada for decades. An interesting evolution, I think she felt, and an evolution, but not an evolution at the same time, in that the structures stay the same, but obviously language moves on as well.
Yeah, so here is Iman Mersel.
A place we often start is in asking how you first started writing seriously, when you first felt of yourself as a writer.
So I actually started writing poems from an early age, as early as, you know, elementary school. So, and I started to publish my poems maybe age 16 in some established good magazines in Cairo. However, I think the moment I thought I want to be a writer more than anything else was 1992. I was doing my master at Cairo University, studying the poetry of Adonis, a famous Syrian French poet. And something happened during this era. It was kind of shift in the way me and my friends, young generation, think about politics and writing and so on. And if you remember early 90s, the Gulf War, the collapse of Soviet Union, which was very important for Arab intellectuals in general. Majority of them in 20th centuries were socialist, communist, and so on. So there was something similar to kind of void, like you don't know what to adapt to, what is the function of writing. Older generations used to be prophets, leaders, important in contributing to social identity, national identity, social class struggle, and so on. So I think during that moment in my life, I thought, I don't want to be an activist. I don't want to be, you know, an academic in particular. I want to be a writer. That's all. So this clarity came in during that time. And soon after, in 1995, my second poetry book was published, which was really part of this movement of new generation writing about individuality more than grand narrative discourses about nation.
You say there was a sort of void. Was it quite clear to you from the start, this sort of difference between a sort of grand narrative, societal approach to writing and more, I guess, internal, individualistic approach? Was that something that you had to sort of work through and slowly come to the realization that that's what you were doing? Or was it quite, it was something that you sort of felt from the beginning? And
it's really a good question, because what I'm saying now would be what I started to understand later. But during the moment, I think this void was felt in so many ways, in I mean, living in Egypt, the poverty is unjust. And of course, even most of the literary venues and magazines and publishing houses were actually controlled by the government or by these old guards who would think that whatever we were writing is not the great Arabic poetry, in terms of themes, the topic, language, and so on. So at the beginning, it felt like kind of alienation, void, a struggle between generations, gender issue, since most of these great writers were men. But also you can feel that you can't fit in. You are defending something you are doing, but you don't have exactly understanding of what's going on in this literary big map. You know what I mean?
What drew you to sort of explore those ideas through words and through poetry as opposed to any other means? There's lots of ways that people might explore that. I guess there's a breakdown of the traditions in one sense and then trying to explore individuality and so on. Obviously, that's something that poetry and writing can do well.
I really think the surroundings were important. So as I'm telling you, if you are 22 years old, poets before you are talking about Arab nationalism, but you see Egypt aligned with America in destroying Iraq, the idea that everyone is relying on and it's part of the production of poetry seemed hollow. So there are reasons around you, the historical moment in which you are learning and questioning things and so on. But there were also personal experience, which is very important in writing, I guess. I was very interested somehow to talk about, for example, the family dynamics, the relation with my father. The question of death was very important for me since my mother died when I was 7 years old. So even in my very early poems, talking about this kind of mystery of death, why? So I think there were some personal reasons for sure, but if you see a whole movement in a literary scene adapting at least these kind of questions, it's bigger than just personal issues. It's really a historical moment that can shape intellectual consciousness.
In terms of the impetus for those sort of early poems, I guess on the one hand, how easily those poems came and the sort of genesis of each poem, was it a fairly defined moment that you'd have an idea or see something or read something and think, now I will write a poem about this? Or were you sort of writing lots of stuff and slowly editing it and the poems would emerge from what you had? And also how that process of coming up with new ideas, how that's changed since then and to now.
One can say that we go through stages in our career as writers. So I think in the 90s, for example, I was impacted by so many poets, translated poetry. There was this Iraqi poet, Sarkun Boles, who is Christian from Assyrian descent. He actually walked from Baghdad to Beirut in the late 60s. And from Beirut, he was able to go to San Francisco and translate lots of the Peat generation. And he himself is a fantastic poet who doesn't rely in ideology, sentimentality, and he had impact on me. Absolutely, there is impact always. But I was impacted by so many poets from everywhere through translation. But Sarkun Boles in particular was important because he made me believe that we can write different poems in Arabic. It's not that in other language translated to us. Arabic language itself can be less sentimental, more specific. In the poetry, it can draw images, not just metaphors and musical sentences, and so on and so forth. So I was for sure impacted by him. I think I edit my poems, but I don't think poetry needs lots of editing. Lots of editing, spoil poems. So this is my experience anyway, because there is a moment that you can capture or not. If you capture it, yes, you might get rid of most of the lines or change the order of things or change a word here or there, but not really intense editing. I feel it spoils the poem somehow.
So is there a point that you know when any more working on the poem would diminish it? Or, I mean, does that just come from experience, or is there some kind of intuitive feeling that, okay, it's not perfect, maybe, but that's saying what it needs to say?
Yeah, I think it's from experience. I have a story I can tell you. So I think when I was in grade 12 or so, so, you know, Egyptian men started to go to, in the 80s, to Gulf states after work, even well-educated people like my father, because the economy was very bad in Egypt. So my father was one of them. So he went to Saudi Arabia for a few months. We went to Baghdad for a year during the Iraq-Iranian war. When he came back, the first thing an Egyptian man would do would demolish the old house, the traditional Egyptian house in his village, and build, you know, a concrete, much nicer house with some modern look to it. And this is what happened in our life. So I watched our old house getting demolished, and I saw some of my mother's hair coming out of a small crack in the wall. And this was so, I don't know how to describe it, overwhelming, traumatizing. Like women traditionally in a village like ours would put, when they brush their hair, if they found something in the comb, they would put in a wall, so because they don't want it to touch fire, or they don't want someone to take it and make something against them. You know, it's a whole belief. So since I was in grade 12, I tried to write this image. So I had so many drafts, and I didn't publish any of them. I didn't feel that any of them was successful in capturing all of these layers of feeling about my dead mother, about the demolishing house, blah, blah, blah. Until I came to Canada, and I didn't write poetry for a few years. I was confused, maybe overwhelmed, not interested in writing about nostalgia or comparing between two. I don't know what was it. But anyway, one day I woke up early morning and I wrote this one poem, which is short poem, 2 pages, but it's about this image, about this moment. I saw my mother's hair coming out of a crack in a wall. And that's it. This was the poem. So I think sometimes an image needs time, needs to change your position. Editing will not solve the problem of it. So this is just an example of how I feel there is something we can't predict about poetry. We work hard towards a poem if you are, you know, occupied by something. You give it a space and time, maybe. But still, poetry is not predicted. And it's really something beautiful about it in general.
And did you find that the earlier attempts that you'd made to sort of describe that image, were you recalling any of that at all? Or was it just a complete, not necessarily new insight, but just a complete change of mindset, new approach, completely fresh?
Some really elements of this image reappeared in the poem that I accepted or published. Absolutely. But my position was different. So, I mean, I wasn't that sad. There was no sentimentality carrying this image, which actually is full of sentimentality anyway. You are trying to push back, not to make it very melodramatic, you know? So in early drafts, yes, it was very sentimental. But in the poem and in the success of the poem just being written, I can see that I can capture so many layers. This moment of changing the society in Egypt through Gulf money, demolishing old houses, building these concrete houses, but also the belief of the mother, a message from the mother, a gift, a punishment to see this hair. So something was more complicated, I guess, and also much easier to capture in language. You don't want to fight the language, you know, to put your intention in it. Something has to be a little bit natural too, like.
And do you find with writing prose that prose can handle more editing and pulling apart?
Absolutely. Yeah, it is actually because it is labor as well. For example, Traces of an Ayat, I changed my position in writing the story a few times. So at the beginning, I was fascinated. I want to write an Ayat is Ayat story, a woman who lived in Egypt was born in the 30s in Cairo in a Bourgeoisie family, went to German school, wanted to be a writer, learned Arabic actually to write her only novel. And the whole thing about her life was fascinating. Mental health, social class, Western education, and so on and so forth. So at the beginning, I was writing her story. But in an enlightening moment, if you can say, I thought I'm actually trying to owe her voice. And this is not right. I want her to exist as she was, to be a different person. So I kept trying until that moment when I discovered if I actually write my search for her, the journey I took toward her, this will allow her to exist as someone else without me speaking of it for her. And also it allowed me to read the past in my own way. For example, reading the mental health institution, the kind of treatment she received, the prison law where she struggled for a few years for the custody of her only son, and then her tragic suicide. So changing the position was absolutely important to find my own voice and to give her back her voice as well. So here, do we call it a journey toward writing or changing our position or editing? I'm not sure. Because first draft was really awful. First draft was me writing a biography. This is not my position. I did not want to write a perfect biography. So I wanted to read the past through an ayat. I wanted to ask the question about individuality in the 50s and 60s under Abdul Nasser. And my question of individuality during the 90s and what's going on now, and how can we read all of that? So somehow, you know, working hard towards something, you might find it's not right or wrong position, but it's the position that really suits your spirit and soul and questions.
Compositionally then, if you changed the point of view, or not really the point of view, the approach that you were using. You'd written a first draft, because in the book as it exists, you speak to relatives of old people who would have known and things like that, or people who would have known relatives of her. Had you already had those conversations and then you decided to use that as part of the book after writing a biography once through? Or did the failed first draft lead you on to ask more questions, which then developed the form of the book as it has now?
So when I talk about first draft, it's not a complete draft of the book, obviously. I mean, you are writing about this woman, so writing about, you know, your question about her and what you know, and fragments from conversation with actress Nadia Lotfi or her sister. But then you face this wall, right? Because there is no archive. I want to talk about the difficulty of accessing archive, of her, the Bourgeoisie family destroying an archive to protect their reputation. I want to talk about, I don't know how did she talk this 20 pink pills to commit suicide. Which kind of you know, pills did she take? I have no idea. Which kind of treatment did she receive for depression in the 50s or early 60s before her suicide? These kind of questions, you face a wall. You can't even keep telling the story because what you are interested in does not fit well with the idea of I'm telling the story of an Ayat. It's bigger than this. It's going back and trying to really read the traces. If there is no archive, you are trying through research to create this archive. So the form of just telling the story is not working.
when you put writing before any other thing, when you prefer writing to money, to your friendship, to all pleasures of life, writing comes first.
I just want to jump in on the idea of fiction that we started with. Did you have sort of clear lines? Because obviously a lot of authors we speak to, they would go away, do research. They say, I don't know what sort of pills it was, but I'll research what was around and then I'm going to make a decision and, and write that. I'm going to decide. There's no evidence what they were, but I'm going to decide it's this and then write a scene where she takes those specific pills. But that is obviously then delving into the realms that's quite clearly fiction if you're making stuff up that hasn't got any basis in any evidence. But did you have sort of clear lines in your mind in terms of, if there's nothing there, there's no way that I'm going to go any further? Or was that a process that you had to explore as you were you sort of writing drafts?
So the process was, you can actually, through research, find out more than what we are told, right? So if you go to the hospital, private hospital, where she was treated for depression twice as a 12 years old and just before her suicide, I found them building this small archive with all of medication. I wasn't allowed to see her file, of course, but I got enough information about who was treating her, which kind of medication she was receiving, which kind of pills was pink and was made by this Swiss company, sold during this time, and what is the impact of it? What does it mean to take this 20 pills, for example? What would you feel? I wanted to understand more than anything, right? I don't want to make an it is a yet a melodramatic story about a talented woman who wanted to be a writer, but she committed suicide because there was no way to go. There was no room for an individual voice like her in the canon of Arabic literature. I don't want to make it a melodramatic. I want it to be a story that can help us actually understand what's going on now. And that is not the only woman. There are Arab women who are writers who might be going through similar things in their life at the moment. So how can you widen this? So in certain moment, I felt it's actually about reading the past. And in order to read the past, you need actually to search it, right? And you have to do this and keep a distance. Yeah. And talking about fiction and nonfiction, as soon as I decided to write the story of my search for Anayat, I felt like everything is coming to its place in a beautiful way, right? So even the editorial work is actually specific.
So in that as well, you're approaching it with the same, because obviously there's a lot of auto fiction out there that sort of takes the author or the narrator, it puts them into the story, and sometimes that is as factual as nonfiction, and sometimes it's as fictional as fiction. And reading that sort of auto fiction, you never really know whether the author did do all the things they say or whether. Sometimes, obviously, it's obvious when the narrative goes into fantastical worlds. But in the most part, you can read and you don't know. But when you were writing, was it important to have the same sort of veracity and closeness to facts in what you're writing about yourself and what you did as what you were finding about Anayat as well? Or were they kind of two separate strands in terms of your approach?
I think they are related. Like, you have a question, an Egyptian writer, female writer, has a question about a woman who lived and wrote her novel 30 years before her. So when I read her novel in 1993, it had this great impact on me. Arab women can write about their internal journey. It's huge. I didn't know that. She was not part of the canon I studied at university, and I studied Arabic literature, and I was already a published poet. I never heard her name. So why someone is excluded? You start with these questions, but these questions shift during my own life. I left Egypt, I became a mother, academic in the West, blah, blah, blah. But Inayat kept visiting me, right? So writing about her, you have to have an imagination, either you are writing fiction or nonfiction. Absolutely. It's like if you read Cydia Hartman writing, for example, about her beautiful body of work about the slave trade in 16th, 17th century. And Cydia Hartman is actually going to access the archive of the traders, the white British and the Arabs who were, you know, facilitating this slave trade. So she is reading their documents in order to capture a picture, a close picture of those victims of slave trade. She had to rely on imagination, I believe so. But you have to be very clear when you are filling gaps through your imagination. I am the one who is searching, and in while you are reading the book, I would say, I imagine that day that Inayat came back from work, went to her apartment, did blah, blah, blah. I am imagining. You can also imagine what this individual did or didn't do. So I'm very clear about my attempt to fill gaps. But also I was very keen to document whatever information, even citing books or sentences from interviews and so on. I was actually fascinated with the process. I want these things to be included. I don't want my imagination to be the main source to write this story.
Was it a very different process you felt from, I mean, obviously in terms of what you've described so far, it's quite different from writing poetry, but
it is.
Did you feel that from the outset that this was a sort of completely new project, or did it feel like a natural extension of academic work, or how did it sort of fit in within your writing world?
A writer can write, you know, in different genres for sure. I'm not really occupied a lot with this question because I write academic work, I write poetry, and I write also prose pieces. I wrote lots of them. So about accent, about travel, about politics. I mean, so I consider myself a writer. So with Traces of Inayat Zayat, it was my second nonfiction book because I published a book on how to mend on motherhood and its ghosts, which is actually a cross-genre book, you know, tackling the question of motherhood between personal experience, reading, and even working with motherhood and photography. So Inayat was my second book. It was completely different than my first nonfiction book because of the story, because of the process, and so on. I think really, as a poet, I can't enter anything without a kind of poetic question. So either I'm writing my, you know, dissertation in my PhD about images of America in Arabic travel literature, or writing about Inayat Zayat. I have this poetry giving me energy to go around, and poetry is visible in the book. Visible meaning, I didn't put poems in the book, right? But the way you are even thinking about a story is impacted by poetry.
Do you feel the same restriction to sort of research and tie everything to fact when you're writing poetry as you did writing in nonfiction? Or do you feel, I don't know, freer in a sense that you can add something in, that you see something here in the concrete, but you have an idea for a poem, but you can add something more than what was actually there because it makes sense poetically, whereas you wouldn't add anything in terms of nonfiction?
This is a really difficult question. I think even poetry has kind of search and knowledge in it, but it's embodied differently. So if I'm writing now a book, I'm working now on a book about actually Baghdad, and it's creative nonfiction book, but it's actually trying to see the city differently through different lens. It's not a travel account. So I'm doing lots of search.
Would you do research for a poem typically? Or
it happens sometimes to search for a poem, but it's not important. It doesn't happen often. It's not a defined threshold toward a poem to do this search. And because sometimes you are inspired by a smell or an image or something, the funny work of memory or association between two things that you never saw them linked before. I mean, it's just a different, I think, way or different process.
On that, when you have a sensation or an idea like that, what would be your process if you have one in terms of noting that down or recording it? Would you just hold it in your head and wait until the next moment that you were in front of pen and paper or in front of your computer? Or would you sort of tend to note down, you know, a couple of words just as a reminder, and it might be 3-4 days before you actually come to write it? Or would you not note down anything ever and just trust that when the time comes, it will be there in your brain to ready to become a poem?
Every writer has a very tiny notebook that they work with. So sometimes you write a note as well as maybe your shopping, you know, list or reminding yourself of something you have to do. This is a deadline. It's mess, right? It's a messy notebook. And it doesn't mean that every single thing you write will develop into something or it will be visible right away. You know, sometimes you would be writing something, a poem, and you say, oh my God, I think I tried to write this 2012 when I was living in Berlin and this image was even conceived there. You know what I mean? But actually the note you wrote in 2012 doesn't exist anymore because you lose things too. You lose these notes, you know, all the time as well. So I think it's funny business. In order to sit and write, there is kind of urgency that doesn't happen every day. Absolutely. Especially with our life, where you have to go teach, when you are responsible for things, when you are sitting like last 3 days just following the news, not able even to think about anything, right? So it doesn't mean that you are writing these notes to yourself that you will go back to it specifically, but also losing it doesn't mean that it's lost. Maybe it come back in different shape and way.
Would you actually open the notebook at all? I mean, when you do come to your desk, you think, oh, I've got some time, some headspace to write some poetry. Would you sort of pull out the notebook and sort of read through it? Or is it done its purpose by writing it down? And
I think it's done its purpose. I mean, you open a new page or the screen in front of you and whatever actually is coming is what deserves to be considered. I don't think anybody writes important thing and then forget it completely. It doesn't happen this way, I think.
No, yeah. I mean, we obviously have lots of different conversations with authors. So it was fascinating to hear the different approaches. And mm-hmm. Some people have, you know, color-coded notebooks. And if it's an idea about memory, that goes in that notebook. If it's an idea about relationships, it goes in... You know, other people don't use notebooks at all, or
because there are so many ways of writing, right? I mean, writing poetry. Like I look around me now. Maybe I'm a traditional poet, finally, old poet. I look around me and I see, for example, what's going on in creative writing programs around me, and I feel really scared, right? Like it's like when you give someone a project, like write a poem in this form, and there is a deadline, and there is lots of discussion and editing. This kind of process, I really even don't understand. So talking about being a modern poet does not mean to adapt this kind of process at all. I'm still loyal to just the basic urgency. There is something urgent you have to write. If it's not urgent, it's not important. If you can read something or go out for a walk or listen to music and feel okay, It's not that important. You don't have to write a poem every month either. Do we? I mean, the world is not waiting for our poems.
I don't want that to be a bombshell revelation to anyone listening to suddenly realize. Do you write poetry only in Arabic? Do you write in English or any other languages as well?
I write poetry only in Arabic.
And do you feel there are some things... not conceptually, that would be crazy, but like there is maybe an English turn of phrase that you hear, a sort of North American idiom or something, that would be really perfect, but there's no way to conjure it particularly well in Arabic.
I think the English way of putting this idea or notion actually come to me a lot when I write prose work on Arabic. And sometimes it's like you are stuck. I'm an Arab writer who is thinking about archive in English, right? And then I have to write this in Arabic. It happens this way sometimes, but poems are different. I think poems, language is very important. So fighting with your own language to exist, to make your feeling or this image that is occupying your imagination exist in your own language is very like natural thing that I experience. I don't think about English language then at all. Yeah. Even if I'm writing a poem about here and there, I have this very short poem in my 2006 book, Alternative Geography. It's a conversation between me and my son, who was 4 years old. So he is speaking in English and I'm speaking in Arabic. And the poem is exactly like that. A question in English and answer in Arabic. And sometimes you are torn this way, but this use of two languages in itself is a poem. It's just the impossibility to do it otherwise, right? My son does not speak my language. But we fight with our own language, really. I mean, by fighting, this is the language others imposed on us through political discourses, through talking about what's right and wrong. This is the language that had great history of poetry. Arabic poetry is amazing and existed from pre-Islamic time. Students in high school can read a poem that was written 1500 years ago. This doesn't happen in any other language as far as I know. So you have this heritage and different schools and great poets, even those who were prophets in 20th century, like Mahmoud Darwish or Adonis. They are great poets. We don't want to write like them, but they are fantastic. So what I'm trying to say, you are trying to create this 3 centimeter of your voice in this huge landscape of poetry in your own language, right? And you mean it.
Does that mean then, because of the history of Arabic poetry, that there is a kind of literary register that is more widely pan-Arabic than the sort of local dialect version? So it works, it has readership or potential readership across the Arabic-speaking world. And also, does that mean that innovation becomes trickier because there are so many structures and things built in over 1,500 years or whatever that people consider that's what poetry has to be?
Yeah, for centuries, poetry remained as a supreme art in Arab culture. I'm not saying that it's more difficult to be a unique poet in Arabic than other languages. It's always difficult to be a poet in any language. But yes, there are so many registers, it's true. There are so many good poets, alive poets, who are writing using the same language like you. But the choice of writing in English, because I came to North America, for example, and I'm working and living here, it could be a social solution to make your life much easier, right? I lived here for years. I'm the one who is teaching at University of Alberta, or the mother of this, you know, baby. Like your identity is completely gone. And it's really difficult to live a few years like this, right? However, your question has its full meaning when you address it in this language. If it's worthy of translation, some people will translate it, no problem. And this is how we share through translation. I read lots of poetry in translation. Even bad translations that I read when I was a young reader, I still appreciate, because it told me about different way of seeing the world, even if the translation was not that good, right? You will discover that Chimborska is much better than this, or Whitman, or you know. But still, it was a window into other poetry. So this is how I see it. And the idea of writing poems in English for someone who speaks with accent is just a joke for me, you know, because you don't want to rely on an editor to polish your poems. I don't believe even in extensive editing of my poem in Arabic. I will not do this to my poem in English. And it goes on and on. So I think I have a reason. With all of the respect to people who don't know English is not even their, you know, second language. They are not bilingual, but they would decide to write in the language of diaspora just to exist. We can exist anywhere in our own language.
Do you think that applies equally to nonfiction? Like, could you imagine writing a sort of prose piece in English? Or
I do, because if I want to talk, for example, about what does it mean to be an Arab female writer in the West, I write an academic article in English, and it's in peer review periodical. Why not? I teach in English.
Not something specific to poetry, but obviously there are the resonances. In poetry,
it's different.
It operates as a reader and writer. It's just operating on a different wavelength than prose.
Right. I'm sure. I mean, in your own experience, sometimes a whole poem will start from a word that it's like it's ringing. It's a word that that is bringing with it a particular image or memory, not just from your individual life, but sometimes it's a collective one. And this collective one takes place in this language, in this history, and so on.
It's so interesting that poetry is the thing that links to the kind of the language you feel most connected to in that way, that you can get the right shape for or something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's a clumsy way of putting it, but I wouldn't be surprised if your experience is a common experience to people who are multilingual, who start writing poetry in one language. It would just always feel like the right material to use for it.
And you see now around like bilingual poets writing poems, for example, in English. I saw this in Canada more than once, but the poem is full of terminology or words coming from their original language. And I really have no, you know, particular thing against that, but I think the ambitious is to bring both languages together. So something will be not translated in the poem you are reading. Always, it's a position in the world. But am I interested in this? I don't think so.
Don't know if there's any difference with Arabic. And I mean, I'm not multilingual at all. But English, I feel is a lot more. There's it depends where you speak English, but it can be quite a mix of other languages and idioms are sort of adopted. I don't know how Arabic is in terms of, is it fairly, you talked to the traditions, but is the language itself fairly fixed in some way in comparison with English?
This is a very difficult question for me. I can't really even answer it, seriously. Like, I think I can't talk about Arabic language and the English language. I mean, I'm not the one who can really compare anything, but I can tell you about my position as someone who is very interested in language. Like sometimes, especially when I write prose pieces in Arabic, I really sometimes think in English. Why? Because of the habit. Because you have been thinking for 20 years in your everyday life in English, right? Even to convince your son with a logical thing, you speak English. So I speak to him all of the love and you know, nice stuff in Arabic. But as soon as we are having a serious conversation about a book or his future or whatever, I'm not happy about it. It's English, okay? So you are torn already between the two languages, and sometimes one of them is fighting for its own existence. So I was giving a reading in Minneapolis 2 days ago, in October 10, and everything was going just perfect. Questions from audience and reading poems, and suddenly a word in English escaped me completely. Like, it just felt like it's impossible to bring it back, okay? So my brain was racing to find an alternative in English. That's it, right? So it happens. It happens in both languages.
And that happens to me in English. Yes. Yeah.
So thank you to Iman for joining us, and thank you for listening.
You can find more about the podcast at unsignedmethods.co.uk, or we're on Twitter, X, It's Unsane Methods.
And you can find out about me and my writing at jamiebatchin.com or at jamiebatchin on X/Twitter or at jamie_batchin on Instagram.
And you can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com, or I'm at lachlanbloom on Twitter as well.